This week on Western Context, we have a very special episode where we have a look at the current leadership team of Trudeau's Liberals, and we delve into the history of the Liberal Party of Canada's prime ministers, as well as a look to the future of the Liberal Party policy ahead of the 2019 election. This is Western Context, episode 120, The History of the Liberal Party. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are in again once this week, as per usual.
As per usual, we are in, but it's not going to be a very usual episode for us. We are going to do a very special episode where we kind of do a callback to an episode that we did last year and where we covered the history of conservatism and the Conservative Party in Canada. And instead, we're going to do the flip side of that.
That means, of course, we're covering, no, not of course, the flip side of that is not the NDP, as some people might think, is the opposite of the Conservatives in various areas, but we are indeed going to be covering the history and current policies and current leadership of the Liberal Party of Canada, often called the natural governing party in this country, and we'll go through some of that history to highlight why that may have been the case and what the party can look forward to in the 2019 election of all things. And we're going to start off with this by talking about the current leadership team. And obviously, when we talked about the Conservative government last year in that special episode, we talked about them as opposition, whereas this time we have the ability to talk about a government that is currently in power. So what we're going to do is we're going to run through some prominent faces in the cabinet, and this cabinet is very large. This is a very large government in terms of the executive head of it, and that is fairly common when it comes to the Liberal Party of Canada. So we're going to start off with that. And of course, the first person who probably needs no introduction for this is Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister. Now, Justin Trudeau became Liberal leader in 2013 after a tumultuous decade of seeing Stéphane Dion and Michael Ignatieff try to lead the party to power. After failing both times, the party turned to its past in electing Justin Trudeau. He became leader on the first ballot with 80% of the votes, 80% of the points needed out of a total of 100%, Justin Trudeau won on the first ballot. So it was a commanding win. The party effectively coronated him. Now, you might be wondering, what exactly did Justin Trudeau do prior to becoming a politician? Well, you know, we look at some politicians and they're farmers or they're accountants, or they might even have a history in space, as we're going to talk about with one of the cabinet ministers. But before he entered politics in 2008, Justin Trudeau served as a substitute drama teacher and a snowboard instructor in BC. And, you know, you're probably wondering, how did this guy rise to prominence and become the leader of the Liberal Party and ultimately the Prime Minister of Canada? Well, he first rose to prominence in a charity boxing match between himself and Conservative Senator Patrick Brazeau that was spearheaded by Ezra Levant and the then Sun News Network. And I think in the past, Ezra on his Rebel Media News channel has said he regrets holding that boxing match and bringing Justin Trudeau to national prominence. Now, we're going to go through the rest of the cabinet here, and the cabinet of the Liberals is very deep in terms of depth, but we'll have a look at what exactly their actual qualifications are as we move through that. And the first person we'd like to actually talk about is Ralph Goodale, who is the Minister of Public Safety and Emergency Preparedness. Now, Ralph Goodale is a household name when it comes to this party in Canada. He's been a politician since 1974 as a Liberal at the federal level, which means, of course, that he served in Pierre Trudeau's caucus, which, of course, is the father of our current Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. He took a bit of a break from federal politics to return to Saskatchewan. He then headed back to federal politics in 1993 and served in many portfolios under Prime Ministers Paul Martin and John Chrétien. When Trudeau appointed his cabinet in 2015, Goodale was seen as a stabilizing force due to his many years of experience and was one of the few with actual governing experience when that cabinet came in. Next up is Dominic LeBlanc, who is the Minister of Intergovernmental and Northern Affairs and Internal Trade. And it's worth noting with this that Dominic LeBlanc is Justin Trudeau's childhood friend. He has represented his New Brunswick riding since the year 2000, and under Trudeau, he has served as leader of the government in the House of Commons, Minister of Fisheries, Oceans, and the Canadian Coast Guard, as well as Ministry of Intergovernmental Affairs, Northern Affairs, and Internal Trade. And of course, the internal trade side, referring to the trade between provinces, which has become an issue in the recent years. Next up is a very important minister, Bill Morneau, Minister of Finance. And prior to running for the Liberals in 2015, he was the executive chair of his family's company, Morneau Chappell, which is a human resources company that was started by his father. The company represents over 20,000 other companies, providing their employees with pension benefits and employee assistance programs. Morneau has also been investigated by the Canada's Ethics Commissioner to determine if there is a conflict of interest with charges that the government made to pensions programs. We talked about this on episodes 42, 40, and 39 of Western Context, and since those episodes, Morneau has been cleared by the Ethics Commissioner of any wrongdoing. Now, this next one is also big. You notice we're starting with the big, important ones and moving forward, but this one definitely had a huge impact on the Canadian economy in the recent years, and that is Foreign Affairs Minister Chrystia Freeland. And this is because she has been the minister responsible for the renegotiation of NAFTA. Before this, she was the Minister of International Trade, so it makes sense that she was moved to Foreign Affairs as Foreign Affairs became the portfolio responsible for renegotiating NAFTA with the United States. Now, before she became a politician, she was in the journalism industry, a freelance reporter for the Financial Times, Washington Post, and The Economist while working in Ukraine. She was also the deputy editor of the Globe and Mail between 1999 and 2001. But perhaps what Chrystia Freeland will be remembered most for is the minister who laid down on the floor in Justin Trudeau's office after finishing NAFTA negotiations to take a rest. Now, our next minister is Mark Garneau, who is the Minister of Transport. He's perhaps has one of the most impressive resumes outside of politics for the Trudeau cabinet, and that's saying a lot. He was the first Canadian in space, and he also rode to space three times on the U.S. space shuttle. He was also president of the Canadian Space Agency from between 2001 and 2006, and his first foray into politics was in the 2008 election. He decided to run for the Liberal leadership in 2013, but he ultimately withdrew from that race and supported Justin Trudeau. His sole cabinet position so far has been as Minister of Transport, and two of the big things he's had to deal with from his time as minister include the Airline Passenger Bill of Rights legislation that effectively sets guidelines for the way that airlines can treat passengers, as well as his response to the ongoing grounding of the Boeing 737 MAX 8 airliners. Next up, we have Jim Carr, who is the Minister of International Trade Diversification, and the key word there is international trade diversification, focusing on our trade relationships aside from the United States. Jim Carr, like Ralph Goodale, has a long history of partisan politics. He first ran for the Manitoba legislature in 1986 as a Liberal, but also like Goodale, he took a break from politics to work for the Winnipeg Free Press in 1998, and he was also the President and CEO of the Business Council of Manitoba. He was first elected for federal politics in 2015 and was the Minister of Natural Resources until July of 2018 when he was moved to his current portfolio. Now, when the lack of pipelines built comes to down to an issue of the whole of government, as we saw here happen in Canada with the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, this was ultimately Jim Carr's portfolio, so it makes sense that he was moved after the Trans Mountain Pipeline had to be bought. Our next minister is the Minister of Defense, which is of course very important in the ever so changing dynamic world that we have here, and that's Harjit Sajjan. We've talked about him many times before on the podcast, and he is perhaps one of the more distinguished members of the cabinet. He emigrated to Canada with his family in 1976 when he was 5 years old. He's lived in the Vancouver area, and he eventually joined the military. He also served numerous tours in Bosnia and Afghanistan and was heavily decorated. He did take some heat from the media when in a public speech he called himself the architect, those were his exact words, of Operation Medusa. Operation Medusa was a Canadian operation to remove the Taliban from the Kandahar province of Afghanistan in 2006. Anyone who knows how the military works will know that offensives are designed by groups of people and not just one. Harjit Sajjan is one of the more distinguished cabinet ministers and has been Trudeau's sole minister of defense. Next up is Amarjeet Sohi, the Minister of Natural Resources, and this is a portfolio we have talked a lot about on Western Context. Sohi was one of Trudeau's star candidates in 2015 in that he is from the West, in particular Edmonton. He was an Edmonton City Councillor and before that worked as a bus driver for the Edmonton Transit System. In the Trudeau government, he served as Minister of Infrastructure, but in July of 2018, he became the Minister of Natural Resources in charge of everything pipelines, and this, of course, was to give Alberta representation at the cabinet table for something that, of course, is integral to Alberta's economy. And Alberta also needed this representation because Calgary MP Darshan Kang resigned from the party amid sexual harassment allegations, and Kent Hare, who held previous cabinet positions such as the Minister of Veterans Affairs and the Minister of Sport and Persons with Disability, was removed after similar allegations arose to him from his time while working in the Alberta legislature. We also have Edmonton Centre MP Randy Bossineau, who is already the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Canadian Heritage. And with that being said, it's worth saying that this is going to be a tough fight for the Liberals to keep any of these seats in Alberta this fall. Our next minister is Marianne Monsef, and she is on this list because her initial foray in the Trudeau government was for Minister of Democratic Institutions, but she has since been demoted to Minister of International Development and Minister for Women and Gender Equality. It was ultimately decided that by this government that they wanted to pursue electoral reform, but through their consultations and I guess we could almost say rigged process, it wouldn't be feasible as there was no clear consensus on what system Canada should adopt. And as we mentioned on the podcast in numerous episodes, this was largely due to the process that was taken. Now, with this, she has also faced controversy by saying that she was born in Afghanistan when she was actually born in Iran. And this, if prosecuted, lying on a citizenship application, is grounds for deportation and the potential revocation of citizenship. Then we have Ahmed Hussein, who is our Minister of Immigration, Refugees, and Citizenship. And this is an important portfolio, but it's also very important for Mr. Hussein because he is actually a new immigrant to Canada, arriving from Somalia in 1994. He's previously worked for the Ontario Legislature for the Dalton McGuinty government. Through 2012, he also served as a member of the Harper government's Cross-Cultural Roundtable on Security that discussed policy issues relating to immigration. He's also a lawyer practicing criminal law, immigration and refugee law, as well as human rights law in Toronto. He was promoted to immigration minister after John McCallum departed the post for China. And Hussein is also, of course, charged with working with our next minister to handle the steady flow of asylum seekers coming into Canada. And that would be none other than Bill Blair, the Minister of Border Security and Organized Crime Reduction. Now, Bill Blair is probably a name you have heard before, as he has served as the police chief of the city of Toronto since 2005 before running for the Liberals. He also initially served as backbencher in the government, but back in July of 2018 was appointed as Minister of Border Security when we saw that there were tens of thousands of asylum seekers coming into Canada. And it's now up to Bill Blair to produce a workable solution, as this is definitely going to become an election issue. Then finally, perhaps one of the portfolios that has drawn the most attention recently, Minister of Justice and Attorney General of Canada, and that is currently held by David Lametti, who was first elected in 2015 for the Liberals and prior to this was a professor at McGill University. He assumed the role after Justice Minister and Attorney General Jody Wilson-Raybould was removed from her position amid the SNC-Lavalin scandal, and it will still be up to David Lametti before the fall election commences to decide if SNC-Lavalin is granted a deferred prosecution agreement, which of course is what this whole huge scandal started off on. Now, we're going to move on to the history of the party in just a couple moments here, but it's also interesting to look at some of the folks who have resigned from the government. And we're actually going to expand this a bit to talk about Gerald Butts, because, well, Butts wasn't a cabinet minister. It's fair to say that he had as much influence on government policy as any of the aforementioned cabinet ministers, because he was Trudeau's principal secretary, and this means that he was Trudeau's advisor for all things. Trudeau and Butts have known each other since their university days, and Gerald Butts also did some work with the former Wynne government in Ontario and the World Wildlife Foundation. And this is where Butts perhaps generated the most controversy, aside from the SNC-Lavalin case, because while he was working with the World Wildlife Foundation, he is famously quoted as saying that in regards to the Northern Gateway pipeline, the best approach would be an alternate economy rather than the energy economy that we have today, rather than looking for a different route for that pipeline project. And as we know, the Northern Gateway pipeline was canceled by the Trudeau government. Now, examining the cabinet and the relationship between Trudeau and Butts and what has happened since the government took power, it's no wonder where we're ultimately at with pipelines today. And that's one side of this case, and we know Gerald Butts also factored into the discussions around SNC-Lavalin, but we also do have to give special mention here to Jody Wilson-Raybould, as it is her actions as resigning from the Ministry of Justice that have moved the government to where it is today, and has effectively formed much of the discussion around this government, the media, and this podcast over the last 3 months. Jody Wilson-Raybould is a lawyer, former Crown prosecutor, and former regional chief to the BC Assembly of First Nations, and without her, her actions as justice minister and the refusal to grant SNC-Lavalin a deferred prosecution agreement after being pressured by the Trudeau PMO, it's unlikely that this government would be where it is today without her actions. So she definitely deserves a mention in this show. We also have to mention Jane Philpott. She was a family doctor from Markham Stouffville, where she practiced until 2015 when she ran for the Liberals, and she became the health minister. And she was actually the first medical doctor to hold the title. And when she was a doctor prior to entering political life, she was actually the associate professor at the University of Toronto's Department of Family and Community Medicine. Now, she, along with Jody Wilson-Raybould, were ultimately expelled from the Liberal Party in April over the SNC-Lavalin scandal. And that's where we're at today. These are most of the prominent figures that have been running Canada's government since 2015, and they're going to be in for a tough fight heading into re-election this October. And we'll just have to watch and wait and see what happens with the policy and what happens with this deck of cabinet officials. Because looking at the cabinet officials, we have some heavy hitters in there, most notably with Ralph Goodale, years of experience, but also with Marc Garneau being an astronaut and running the Canadian Space Agency, and also Harjit Sajjan being a heavily decorated war hero here in Canada. So aside from those three, there's really not much else actual tangible world experience in this government, and I think we're seeing that 4 years later based on the policy that the Trudeau government has put forward.
Yeah, I agree with that as well. I think that's a fairly safe characterization of the Trudeau government, especially the cabinet ministers, from being out of power for 10 years between 2006 and 2015. A lot of the former Chrétien and Martin cabinet ministers either left politics or they went provincial or they went into other fields. And so when Trudeau, you know, kind of surprisingly won the 2015 election after all was said and done, he had quite a few rookie MPs on hand and didn't really have that much from the former days that he could draw on for experience. So in his cabinet are quite a few rookie MPs that have been placed into prominent positions. And I think it's no wonder that we've seen so many scandals from so many different cabinet ministers because of that.
And it all comes back to Gerald Butts and Justin Trudeau. They effectively were the ones pulling the string on this government. And now that Butts is gone, we'll see where they've gone. But we can see that definitely some of the focuses of getting things done, whether it's in regards to tariffs with the U.S. or trade with China, that's kind of disappeared since he's resigned. So the government seems to be a bit on autopilot. But I think we could move to back to the 1800s and actually talk a bit about the history of the party and how we got to where we are today now.
Yeah, that's right. Because I think before we start talking about current policies and why the Liberal government operates the way it does, I think we need to understand the history of them and where they actually come from. And in the history of the Liberal Party of Canada, it is in a lot of cases related to the history of conservatism in Canada, being two opposing sides of the same coin of democratic leadership. Indeed, even the name of the Conservative Party at Confederation in 1867 was called the Liberal Conservative Party. At that time, the differences between liberals and conservatives amounted to differing degrees of how to accomplish the same task. Now, the first few years of the Liberal Party, though they weren't in government for much of the first 30 years after 1867, had a huge influence on Canada's first step as a sovereign country. Now, the original leaders of the Liberal Party were descendants from those who took place in the rebellions of 1837. Now, the rebellion leaders included George Brown, Robert Baldwin, William Lyon Mackenzie, who ended up being the father of William Lyon Mackenzie King, and the Clear Grits in Upper Canada. This was led by Joseph Howe in Nova Scotia, as well as the Patriots and Rouges in Lower Canada, which is now Quebec, which was led by figures such as Louis Joseph Papineau. Now, the Clear Grits and Parti Rouge sometimes functioned as a united bloc in the legislature of the province of Canada beginning in 1854, and a united Liberal Party combining both English and French Canadian members was formed in 1861. So the rebellion of 1837 was fought about political reform and the advent of responsible government, which is a key tenet of our democracy to this day, and thus helped to sow the seed of the Liberal Party. Now, for those wondering, responsible government is a conception of system of government that embodies the principle of parliamentary accountability, which is the foundation of the Westminster system of parliamentary democracy. Governments, or the equivalent of the executive branch in Westminster democracies, are responsible to parliament rather than to the monarch. Now, we may take it for granted these days, but almost 200 years ago, this was a huge deal to fight for, and a big step for Canadians being able to control our own party. Or our own country, rather. Now, much of the Liberal Party's history after Confederation was defined by Alexander Mackenzie, who became the de facto leader of the official opposition after Confederation and finally agreed to become the first official party leader in 1873. He was able to lead the party to power for the first time in 1873 and become Canada's second prime minister after the John A. Macdonald-led Conservative government lost a vote of no confidence in the House of Commons due to the Pacific scandal, where members of the Conservative government were caught accepting bribes from companies trying to win the contract to build a national railway out to BC, which was a key linchpin of BC joining Canada. Now, Mackenzie was a man of humble origins. He was a stonemason and was afforded a position of power which was rarely given to those not of the upper class at the time. One of Mackenzie government's first measures was to introduce secret ballots in an effort to improve the integrity of future elections and other freedom which we take for granted these days. Mackenzie, in his dual capacity of Minister of Public Works, actually oversaw the completion of the Parliament buildings, and he drew up the plans for the West Block himself. However, Mackenzie's principles, his term was marked by an economic depression that had grown out of the Panic of 1873, which Mackenzie's government was unable to alleviate. In 1874, he negotiated a new free trade agreement with the United States, eliminating the high protective tariffs on Canadian goods in U.S. markets. However, this action didn't bolster the economy, and construction of the Canadian Pacific Railway had slowed drastically due to a lack of funding. In 1876, the Conservative opposition announced a national policy of protective tariffs, which resonated with voters at the time. And when an election was held at the conclusion of Mackenzie's term, the Conservatives were swept back into office in a landslide victory, and the Liberals wouldn't return to power until 1896. Now, in 1896, Wilfrid Laurier was elected as the first French-Canadian prime minister, and he won four majority governments after that. That lasted over 15 years. And he's also on the $5 bill. Now, the election of 1896 was dominated by the Manitoba schools question, which was a political crisis involving publicly funded separate schools for Roman Catholics and Protestants. Now, the crisis eventually spread to the national level, becoming one of the key issues in the federal election of 1896. Now, because of the close linkage at the time between religion and language, the school's question raised the deeper question about whether French would survive as a language or a culture in Western Canada. Now, the result of that crisis was that by the end of the 19th century, French was no longer supported as an official language in Manitoba or the neighboring Northwest Territories, which encompassed pretty much the rest of Western Canada at the time. Now, this in turn led to a strengthening of French-Canadian nationalism in Quebec, and this also resulting from the 1885 execution of Louis Riel. Now, Laurier developed a compromise with Thomas Greenway, who was the premier of Manitoba. They agreed that Catholic education would be permitted in public schools and that French would be used in teaching, but only on a school-by-school basis. They also reestablished a Catholic school board, but without government funding. Many Catholics were still opposed to this compromise, and they even appealed to the Pope, Leo XIII at the time. The Pope sent an observer who concluded, like Laurier, that the compromise was the fairest one possible with so few Catholics left in the province. Now, Laurier's terms as prime minister were defined by that early compromise between English and French. He's often considered one of the country's greatest statesmen. He's well known for his policies of reconciliation, expanding confederation, and compromise between English and French Canada. His vision for Canada was of a land of individual liberty and decentralized federalism. He also argued for an English-French partnership in Canada. He once said, quote, "I have had before me a pillar of fire, a policy of true Canadianism, of moderation, and of reconciliation." He passionately defended individual liberty and said, "Canada is free, and its freedom is its nationality, and nothing will prevent me from continuing my task of preserving at all cost our civil liberty." So this was a cornerstone of Laurier's government in that he regarded civil liberties and decentralized government as cornerstones of his policy. Now, Laurier was also well regarded for his efforts to establish Canada as an autonomous country within the British Empire, and he supported the continuation of the empire if it was based on absolute liberty, political and commercial. In addition, he was a strict nationalist, argued for a more competitive Canada through limited government, and was an adherent of fiscal discipline. He also oversaw Alberta and Saskatchewan becoming provinces, and he also led to the creation of the Canadian Navy. Now, the end of Laurier's tenure as prime minister was dominated by relations with the U.S. In 1911, a controversy arose regarding Laurier's support of trade reciprocity, otherwise known as free trade, with the United States. This had the strong support of agricultural interests, but it alienated many businessmen who formed a significant part of the Liberal support base. The Conservatives denounced the deal and played on long-standing fears that reciprocity would eventually lead to the American annexation of Canada. And here we are, over 100 years later. Hasn't happened yet, but you never know, right? You never know what might happen in the future. But contending with an unruly House of Commons, including vocal disapproval from Liberal MP Clifford Sifton, Laurier called an election to settle the issue. But it turns out that the Conservatives were victorious, and Robert Borden succeeded Laurier as Prime Minister. Now, Laurier remained in opposition during the First World War. The 1917 campaign was a bitter campaign of conscription, with English Canada largely supporting conscription to help the war efforts, and Britain and French Canada vehemently opposing conscription, as they felt that they had no particular loyalty to either Britain or France, and that their only loyalty was to Canada. Now, I talked about the conscription crisis on the History of the Conservative Party episode, but needless to say, that crisis opened a deep schism between French and English parts of Canada that still show today, over 100 years later. Now, the Liberals would remain in opposition until 1921, when William Lyon Mackenzie King won election for the first of three lengthy non-consecutive terms in power. Now, King was a very interesting person of history. He lacked the charisma of such contemporaries as Franklin Roosevelt, Winston Churchill. He lacked a commanding presence or oratorical skill. His best writing was academic, and he didn't really resonate with the electorate. He was described as cold and tactless in human relations. He had many political allies, but few close personal friends. He never married, and he lacked a hostess whose charm could substitute for his chill. And It wasn't known at the time, but it came out later that he actually kept secret his beliefs in spiritualism and the use of mediums to stay in contact with his departed associates, and particularly with his deceased mother. And he allowed his intense spirituality and belief in the occult to distort his understanding of Adolf Hitler and other world issues throughout the late 1930s. Now, nevertheless, beyond all that, he was a shrewd and intelligent politician whose tenure in power as Canada's longest-serving prime minister shows that he knew what Canadians needed and wanted at the time. After the bitter conscription crisis, he reconciled factions, unifying the Liberal Party and leading it to victory in the 1921 election. Personally handled complex relations with the Prairie Provinces, while his top aides handled the demands of French Canadians. During the Second World War, he carefully avoided the battles over conscription, patriotism, and ethnicity that had divided Canada so deeply in the First World War, and he modernized Canada into a middle power. Now, in the period just before and after the Second World War, the party became a champion of progressive social policy, which is something that has lasted to this day. King introduced several measures that led to the creation of Canada's social safety net. He also reluctantly introduced old age pensions when J.S. Woodsworth required it in exchange for his Cooperative Commonwealth Federation's party support of King's minority government. Now, King's most trusted minister was Louis Saint-Laurent, who ended up succeeding King as prime minister in 1948, who served until 1957. Saint-Laurent shared many of the same policies as King and kept on the same course of turning Canada into a booming middle power. Now, a staunch nationalist, he was an enthusiastic proponent of Canada joining NATO in 1949 to fight the spread of communism, and his image of a popular prime minister led him to two victories over the Conservatives. Now, Saint-Laurent's tenure could be seen as the first real media image in Canada, where he was displayed as having a common touch that turned out to be appealing to voters. At one event during the 1949 election campaign, he disembarked his train, and instead of approaching the assembled crowd of adults and reporters, he gravitated to and began chatting with a group of children on the platform. A reporter then submitted an article entitled "Uncle Louis Can't Lose," which earned him the nickname Uncle Louis in the media, and it kind of sowed the seeds of what we see nowadays with a cult of personalities being prominent in the media and simple issues like this being blown into epic proportions, where a politician's image is mostly blown up and is keeping them sustained throughout their political life. Now, Saint-Laurent's government was engaged in huge public works projects, including the Trans-Canada Highway, the Trans-Canada Pipeline, and the St. Lawrence Seaway. He also oversaw Newfoundland's joining into Canada in 1949, and by 1957, even though the Liberals were still popular in Quebec, the Progressive Conservatives won every other region. Now, Lester B. Pearson would be the next Liberal Prime Minister in 1963. His term marked plenty of social progress, which included the introduction of national universal health care, the Canadian pension plan, student loans, and a new Canadian flag. In 1967, on the 100-year anniversary of Canada becoming a province, or Canada becoming its own country, he de facto abolished capital punishment in Canada. But Pearson's greatest achievement was before he became prime minister, and he was responsible in defusing the Suez Crisis. And his work with the UN led to the modern definition of peacekeeping and upholding Canada's positive world reputation. Now, Pearson's successor as prime minister was Pierre Elliott Trudeau, and depending on who you speak to, is regarded as one of Canada's best or worst prime ministers. Trudeau became a media sensation, inspiring Trudeau mania that's lasted to this day with his son dressed in Trudeau, and he took charge of the Liberals in 1968. From the late 60s to the mid-80s, his personality dominated the political scene to an extent never seen before in Canadian political life, even surpassing that of Saint-Laurent. His personality and political career aroused polarizing reactions throughout Canada, to say the least. Now, admirers praise what they consider to be the force of Trudeau's intellect and his political acumen, maintaining national unity over the Quebec sovereignty movement, suppressing a Quebec terrorist crisis and fostering a pan-Canadian identity, and in achieving sweeping institutional reform, including the implementation of official bilingualism, patriotism of the Constitution, and the establishment of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Now, critics, on the other hand, accuse him of arrogance, of economic mismanagement, and of unduly centralizing Canadian decision-making to the detriment of the culture of Quebec and the economy of the prairies. The last of that led to Western alienation, which was described as the following rapid release of the price of oil between 1979 and 1980, the government of Pierre Trudeau introduced the National Energy Program, which intended to increase Canadian ownership in the oil industry, increase Canadians' oil self-sufficiency, and redistribute the wealth generated by oil production towards the federal government. The program was extremely unpopular in the West, where most of Canada's oil is produced. It heightened distrust of the federal government, especially in Alberta. Many Albertans believe that the NEP was an unjustified intrusion of the federal government into an area of provincial jurisdiction, which was designed to strip the province of its natural wealth. By keeping the oil prices below world market prices, the eastern provinces were essentially being subsidized at the expense of the western provinces. And I think we still see this today with Justin Trudeau, Pierre-Éliott Trudeau's son, embarking on his own campaign of Western alienation. Now, Trudeau was succeeded as Liberal leader and Prime Minister by former Cabinet Minister John Turner, who had been out of politics for almost a decade. Before handing power to Turner, Trudeau advised Governor General John Sauvé to appoint over 200 Liberals to patronage positions. He and Turner then crafted a legal agreement calling for Turner to advise an additional 70 patronage appointments. The sheer volume of appointments, combined with questions about the qualifications of the appointees, led to condemnation from across the political spectrum. However, an apparent rebound in the polls prompted Turner to call an election for September 1984, almost a year before it was due. Turner's appointment deal with Trudeau came back to haunt the Liberals at the English language debate when Progressive Conservative leader Brian Mulroney demanded that Turner apologize for not advising that the appointments be cancelled, advice that Sauvé would have been required to follow by convention. Turner claims that, quote, "I had no option but to let the appointment stand," prompting Mulroney to tell him, "You had an option, sir, to say no, and you chose to say yes to the old attitudes and the old stories of the Liberal Party." The Liberals never recovered from this. Combined with anger in Quebec at being left out of patriation of the Constitution, the Liberals were heavily defeated at the 1984 election, losing 95 seats in what was then the worst sitting defeat of a sitting government at the federal level. The Liberals wouldn't taste power until Jean Chrétien won in 1993. Now, Chrétien was strongly opposed to the Quebec sovereignty movement and supported official bilingualism and multiculturalism. He won a narrow victory as leader of the Federalist camp in the 1995 Quebec referendum and then pioneered the Clarity Act to avoid ambiguity in the future referendum questions. He also advanced the Youth Criminal Justice Act in Parliament, and he also led Canada to multiple economic surpluses and reduced spending. Although his popularity and that of the Liberal Party were seemingly unchallenged for three consecutive federal elections, he became subject to various political controversies in the later years of his prime ministership. He was accused of inappropriate behavior in the sponsorship scandal, although he has consistently denied any wrongdoing. Now, the sponsorship scandal occurred from 1996 until 2004, when broad corruption was discovered in the sponsorship's operations and the program was discontinued. Illicit and even illegal activities within the administration of the program were revealed, involving misuse and misdirection of public funds intended for government advertising in Quebec. Now, such misdirections included sponsorship money that was awarded to Liberal Party-linked ad firms in return for little or no work, in which firms maintained Liberal organizers or fundraisers on their payrolls or donated back part of the money to the Liberal Party. Now, the resulting investigations scandal affected the Liberal Party of Canada and the then government of Prime Minister Paul Martin, who succeeded Jean Chrétien, and this caused the Liberals to lose grip on power, which they wouldn't regain until the election of Justin Trudeau in 2015, almost 10 years later.
And when we look at the history of the Liberal Party, you see a history in the early years, probably up until the 1950s or maybe even 1960s, that almost mirrors the Conservatives, as you said, of trying to attain the same thing but going about it in a different way. So what you have is, you have effectively boiled down, is a history of the party that is pre-Pierre Trudeau. Then you have the Trudeau era, and you have a bit of a wane, and then the Liberal Party comes back under Chrétien and Martin from 93 to 06. And then, you know, now the party seems to be in a position where they can't define what they want it to be. That, of course, resulted in them being outflanked by the NDP in 2011 and the charismatic Jack Layton being reduced to third party status. And, you know, when we see that, you have to wonder, what exactly is the future of the Liberal Party under Trudeau, or what happens after Justin Trudeau is gone? Because what we effectively have here is, we have those three different eras: pre-Trudeau, Trudeau, Chrétien, Martin, and then now, are we in a Justin Trudeau era, or is the party going to be reshaped if he doesn't win election? And that's where we're at right now in terms of the general history of this party. And I think if we look at some of the current policies that this government has implemented since 2015, we might be able to get a bit of an idea of what things are going to look like going forward. And to do that, you know, it's a very stark contrast, because for Justin Trudeau's Liberals, gone are the days of centrism, trying to attract both those on the center-right and the center-left of the political spectrum, the what we talked about of wanting the same thing but getting it done in a different way. Those days are gone. Also, Paul Martin and Jean Chrétien's era of the Liberal Party is gone too. All you have to do is look at the massive deficits and debt that this government is building up. And looking at the fiscal policy of this Liberal Party that is currently in power, they, of course, favor tax breaks for the middle class, which was never really defined. And we also have the party running steep and deep deficits as far as the eye can see, heading forward to 2040, maybe even 2050 if the current trends continue. The current administration has also held corporate tax rates steady in an era of cutting corporate taxes, as we've seen in the U.S., which has caused Canada to become less competitive business-wise on the international stage. We see numbers that Canada's unemployment rate is at a good, healthy number, and the economy is creating jobs. So the question that people often ask is, why doesn't it feel that way? Why doesn't it feel as though that the country is doing better? And it ultimately comes down to this fiscal policy that puts a damper on investment, both in the terms of debt and deficit that we have, as well as the government's inability to keep corporate tax rates competitive with our direct neighbor and biggest trading partner to the south. Now, this government also, in regards to this, has said that they're focusing on maintaining debt-to-GDP ratios rather than aiming for a zero-deficit government. Their feeling is that if the debt remains at a healthy percentage of the total GDP, that is the total amount of wealth that the country produces in 1 year, the country will be fine. And the downside of this is that, one, there's not as much room to move if there's a recession and the government needs to run a huge stimulus program, as we saw in 2008. And these recessions that require stimulus like that can creep up very quick. There's also the fact that the government and all Canadians are paying interest on the debt that the government keeps building up, and that's going to keep happening. And what we're also seeing with this is a structural reliance on government debt going forward to build projects and ultimately fund day-to-day government operations. Now, this government under Trudeau Jr., has also talked about the environment, and in particular, they have chose to implement a carbon tax. And they have said that they would much rather have the provinces implement their own form of price on pollution, and they have said that if a province doesn't do this, they will step in and implement that tax for the province. They're doing that with Saskatchewan and Ontario and Manitoba and probably Alberta soon as well. Now, the government does say that this tax will be rebated back. We'll have to see what happens when the first batch of 2020 income tax returns come back after having this carbon tax in the works. And the revenues from this tax are also supposed to go into green initiatives, but this hasn't happened anywhere in Canada that has implemented a carbon tax. So it's a dream that this will probably happen. Now, of course, running lockstep with the carbon tax, we have the pipeline file, which we talked about in the current leadership team. And in particular, when we look at pipelines, we see the purchasing of the Trans Mountain Pipeline, Bill C-69, which restructured the National Energy Board that effectively makes it so that this board, when they're reviewing projects, need to not only consider the environmental impact of the pipe in the ground, but also the environmental impact of anything that the product that's being carried in that pipe will cause later on downstream, as they call it. This government has also implemented Bill C-48, known as the tanker ban off of BC's northern coast. But what it really is a ban on Canadian oil leaving the country because, of course, ships are still free to come into the port of Vancouver and bring in their gas for the lower mainland. The government has also purchased the Trans Mountain Pipeline for up to $4 plus billion last year. And they're all doing this. They're implementing the carbon tax. They're focusing on making it harder to approve these projects and actually get the oil out via tanker. And they're doing this while they say that they support the Trans Mountain Pipeline and support resource development. And this is perhaps the biggest oxymoron we've ever seen in Canadian government policy. Now, as we also mentioned, the party has shifted towards the left in recent years, and we saw this in the 2015 election where the Liberals capitalized on the NDP's voter base. And while there's still a difference between the NDPs and Liberals on social policies, the Liberals of 2015 and 2019 are decidedly more progressive than the Liberals of 2005 or the Paul Martin or Jean Chrétien Liberals. In terms of defense spending here in Canada, the government canceled the F-35 project and elected to purchase used F-18s from Australia. And questions remain as just to how much it will cost Canada to pull out of this multi-country F-35 deal and just how long we'll be able to keep these F-18s in service reliably and safely. Because we need to remember that the F-18 is a late Cold War era aircraft. It took its first flight in 1978 and entered service in 1983. That's over 30 years ago. So this is something that the government has definitely gone backwards on, and we've talked about this numerous times on the podcast, whether it be the planes or whether it be the fact that the government has ordered non-active Canadian soldiers to return their rucksacks and backpacks in order to ensure that there are going to be enough for the working forces. Another thing that this government has infamously or maybe famously done, and depending on perspective, is, of course, hashtag Welcome to Canada. That's a tweet that Justin Trudeau put out a week after Donald Trump became president, welcoming irregular refugees and border crossers into the country, as they call them. And this has been, of course, one of the big chapters here for Western context. Over 42,000 people have arrived in Canada since January of 2017. They've been housed in stadiums, hotels, and the RCMP intercept them in terms of what is a blatant violation of the Safe Third Country Agreement, which is an agreement that says that those entering either the U.S. or Canada must make their asylum claim in the first country in which they set foot. And we've seen that the government wanted to renegotiate this with the U.S., but as with all things this year with this government, the constant focus has been on SNC-Lavalin, and with that, they really haven't been able to get much done on this file, and this is going to become an election issue. Now, the government also wants to increase the amount of annual immigration, that is the amount of legal immigration that comes into Canada, to 350,000 new migrants by the year 2021. Currently, we bring in 310,000 immigrants per year, and the government says that these immigrants will address shortages in skilled labor markets, and they want to use the immigration program to effectively ensure that the Canadian economy will keep trucking forward. And you're probably wondering, what is the biggest thing policy-wise that this government could have done better? And, you know, why are we saving this one for last? And, you know, quite frankly, that comes down to foreign policy. We've talked about the Chinese trade deal. Justin Trudeau went to China. It was widely expected that we would see progress, that China might want to start negotiating a free trade deal with Canada. Justin Trudeau was sent home with no indication that a trade deal is any closer in terms of China. We also have issues in China with the Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou, and she has been in Canadian custody since December. And this is something that, of course, Canada could use to its advantage with China. It could use to its advantage with the United States. But this opinion, as with everything that's happened in 2019, has been squandered. So that's one country, China, where foreign policy didn't go as planned. Another is India. Recall that this is when the shine of Justin Trudeau first came off. If you look at public opinion polls, Justin Trudeau and company went to India, and this India trip was over budget, and it actually resulted in a convicted felon being brought into the ranks of the delegation that traveled with the government to Canada. And this produced one of the biggest head scratchers ever for us here at Western Context. The question was, do you believe our government? Do you believe our media? Or do you believe what the Indian government is saying? And we never really were able to figure out what exactly the best way to go on this was, but we were leading to the fact that the Indian government probably had the best story on this. And we've seen that relations with India really haven't improved since that happened. We also have trade deals. Of course, this government signed on to the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a huge trade deal spanning many countries in the Western Hemisphere. But of course, the biggest one that people need to, of course, remember and think about is NAFTA, or as it has been termed and will be rebranded once it becomes ratified, USMCA. This was one of Donald Trump's biggest promises when he became president, that he was going to renegotiate NAFTA. And this is something that it looked like for a long time that Canada might not get a deal out of this. We might have to pursue a second trade deal with the United States on a bilateral level. But the trade deal did get done, but it only got done where Canada was able to sign on to an agreement in principle that the United States made with Mexico. So Canada wasn't even the leader on this trade negotiation with the United States. It was the U.S. and Mexico that led it. We've also, of course, seen significant investments in the G20 while this government has been in power, as well as this has been a contentious issue for us talking about the numerous stories on that here in the past on Western Context. We had cases where cars were bought, where swing sets and outdoor equipment was bought, only to be sold later at a huge loss for the government and Canadian taxpayers. And of course, we also do have what Justin Trudeau was aiming for and promised he would get when he was elected, the hunt for one of those temporary UN Security Council seats, which being a temporary UN Security Council seat definitely holds some sway, but not nearly as much sway as the permanent members of the UN Security Council have. So while we see that the government here in Canada has tended to focus on policies that look well and sell well in the media, much like the government cabinet, most of the policies that have been brought forward aren't really that substantive. And we've been left wondering if we could have gotten more in a lot of these cases on the foreign policy front, the defense front, our border, the pipelines. And it seems as though that after 4 years, all we got is a carbon tax and not as many pipelines as we potentially could have had under a different government had the Conservatives been reelected in 2015. And this is something that many Canadians are going to look at. And juxtaposing this with all the history of the Liberal Party that we've talked about, being called the natural governing party of Canada, we have to wonder, is that are the policies of the Trudeau government really that great? And are they something that Canadians can be proud of after 4 years? And that's going to be a question that's going to be answered in this fall's federal election.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And what you mentioned about the juxtaposition of the Liberals and Conservatives just doing the same thing differently, but gone are those days, of course, and we're into a very different period of Canadian politics where the Liberal Party seems to be doing something completely different from what they've ever done in the past, and that is, of course, moving further to the left and introducing these socially progressive policies, but not actually having that much impact in Canada. And it's very interesting to see how they've done that. A lot of the policies and promises that they made in the 2015 election have gone by the wayside. And out of those, the only ones that were major planks of the policy that they actually were able to do was the legalization of marijuana. And even that was flawed in a sense. A lot of stores are still struggling to open, and governments are fining these stores for not being able to open. And lots of regulations and confusion are still abounding this, and lots of people are actually going back to the black market because of the failures of the government to actually set up legalization correctly. So even the one thing that they were able to do out of their policy planks, that real interest to Canadians, and one of the reasons why the Liberals were elected, wasn't even done correctly. So all of these scandals and all of the questions that have arisen in the last 4 years are something that the Liberals haven't really addressed, and they haven't really fixed either. So it's definitely leading a lot of questions, and I think that's where we're at for policy, because gone are the days of getting the job done, just doing it in a different way than the Conservatives would do. Now it's not getting the job done and doing a completely different thing. And we'll have to see where this leads to the future, of course.
And that's why I think segmenting it in terms of pre-Trudeau, Trudeau, Gretchen Martin, and then a big question mark for what this era of the Liberal Party is going to look like. Because after the 2011 election, there were many questions that, you know, should the NDP and the Liberals merge together to effectively coalesce the center-left of the political spectrum in Canada? Because looking at the policies of the current government, that's where they want to be. And if you listen to our episode couple weeks back, you will see, of course, that, you know, the Green Party did win their second seat ever in the Canadian House of Commons this week out on Vancouver Island in Nanaimo, and that could be a big issue for them heading into the fall election this year. And we'll have to see if these policies, compared to what we know of the past decades of the Liberal Party of Canada, are going to be enough to drive this party forward and elect them to a second mandate, because as we know in Canada, it's very unlikely for majority governments not to get reelected in their first term. So that's going to be a big question for us.
And for Trudeau to not be elected for a second term would mark a very different approach to what has gone on in history. Almost all of the former Liberal prime ministers that I mentioned during the history segment got elected to at least one majority, if not more than that. The only one who didn't was Leslie Pearson, who was elected to two consecutive minorities, which is also something that's fairly rare. But the fact that Trudeau had such an overwhelming majority after 2015 and is now in jeopardy, that's definitely something that's quite interesting, and just proves that the path that the Trudeau Liberals are on is leading to a lot of uncertainty.
Indeed, and you know, we do these specials because they're important. In order to do what we do and provide all the information and context necessary to put listeners on the right side of the news, that necessitates an understanding of history in order to build that context. And that's what we're doing with this Liberal Party special as we move forward towards the fall federal election. And I think that's a good spot to wrap the show up. So I'll just say that if you want full show notes for this, you can find that at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to us on iTunes or any other number of podcast listeners out there. Head on over to westerncontext.ca/subscribe to figure out how to do that. And if you want to follow us on Twitter and Facebook, you can do that as well at Western Context. And with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of the stories that the media covers, some that they don't cover, and to look at the history, what's going on, and what has happened in the past, just to make sure that you have the context necessary to put yourself on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.